Yeah. you bump into people and so on, and you hear a whole lot of stories. But, so what I'm saying is, I think leave it there, because otherwise it means, if we say there was no cooperation between the two sides, that means we still have to carry on our work. That means your request to us at the meeting still must continue. We must call them back until we are. We'll sit here for hours and hours. And can we, in the current situation of sportsmanship, right, where nothing is as it seems, and you're not going to mark this to believe that, that we're going to sit here for hours. No, I think it's for now, until something new emerges, as will no doubt happen tomorrow morning or the day after. For now, this is it. We don't say there's no evidence. We said there's no, we could not conclude. In other words, we can say, we could not conclude that there was no lack of cooperation. We could not conclude that. The commissioner delivered to us dates of letters. Right? And those letters actually, the dates seem to be reasonably close to the 18th of May or thereabouts. So in other words, we don't have anything that we can prove. The commissioner is giving you letters that don't exist. Or you can prove that the FIC guy is lying to us. How you prove that? On the legal issue, I came towards saying it makes no sense to me. I'm not a lawyer, Momo, but there's no reason why a parliamentary committee can't ask the FIC about closing. I mean, really, that's weak. So I really, we have mandated, what's his name, Advocate Jenkins over November. Not now, Advocate Jenkins, nobody can, we don't do anything, right? You can go to the anti-state, we cannot do anything more. You and I know how much we can do. I need to alert you, because I'm sure it's done, well, I suspect it's done in court papers. You will get stuff on the SAA reply to us in the written form. There is now questions about the accuracy of that. I've referred it to Advocate Jenkins, and I think right now, let him manage the issue. I will write to SAA, the minister, the deputy minister, the DG, and to ALCA, and say, look, guys, Parliament will do its work. We are meeting with them, I think, on the 8th of November. Is that right? So basically what I'm saying is, my view is we leave it there, and we can vote on it if you want. Okay, on the PIC, if you look, because we're saying nothing there actually, but we're saying we did our job to the extent we can, but for now this is where we take it. We will in fact bring the commissioner here to explain what has been done about the alleged allegations against two officials concerned in January or February when they come here, February probably. Two is, we are going to write to the minister now once it's been adopted to say, hey, and to the minister of SAPS, that I think it's fair, if the FIC takes a case to the SAPS, the SAPS must respond to the FIC and say why. And we are doing what you said. We agreed to it last year. In fact, as the chairperson of the committee, before statements get issued, to say it's a request, and people have been fighting for months to do it now. Let's do it. We'll have to do it in February. Next issue, 13, observations and recommendations, Auditor General's report. After that, sorry, we're looking now at the PIC. There's found 13.1 to 13.8. Any questions, comments, contributions? Just explain it.
Chair, on 13.8, I would suggest that we retain the first sentence and delete the balance of that paragraph. The fact of the matter is, the PIC would not have voluntarily disclosed this information in the unlisted portfolio had they not been put under pressure to do so. Now, whether we agree with that or not agree with that is irrelevant. Why don't you just simply welcome the fact that they've released
let me move it out of there to something above where we note that. Because I think it is irresponsible to make wild allegations about the PIC, you know, that it's doing all these things. You can put in words like, for now, this is a view. But I don't think it's a topic. Because if you look at the PIC responding in yesterday's business day, and you see the interview with the PIC head in the business report, and you see their presentation here. In fact, it was Mr. Croy who said, hey, you know what? Continue to do what you're doing. Right? And I could have retorted, but I was kind enough not to Croy. He's got an ANC position, but I didn't. So what I'm saying is, no, Croy is absolutely right. They must go ahead, we want them. That last sentence is very revealing that the DA wants removed. This is what the DA wants removed. Maybe, have you got time? Mr. Pule, issue a press statement and say what the DA said. The committee encourages the PIC to do more to deracialize the economy.
Yes. We must leave that sentence.
Leave that there. Issue a press statement. Go on TV. Go on to radio stations that you can never reach because you can't speak any indigenous language. Just like me, but I mean, go on. Yes, Mr. Shibambu.
Thank you, Chair. I think 3.6 is to create the PIC should be created the representation of black and other villages. And then continue with that. Not to continue. I don't think that there was a counter view when we say that the clear mandate should be that the black African villages must be more than the other villages.
Yeah, we can drop that with me. The reason it could be a sometimes close. Although in this case, you're right, it's wrong. It's because sometimes it's not appropriate, given market sensitivity, for MPs to be instructed certain entities, right? So what we should consider, what we really mean is, when they come here, we're not going to say, hey, you consider, what have you done? But I think you're right in this case, shall we remove consider? Good. Now, on the other matter, I've suggested a compromise. It doesn't fit in as a recommendation. I think we should move this. We said the majority, because I knew you know, you are about it. We said the majority in the committee. If you want, we can say the committee except the DA. Maybe that's what we should do. So, you know. Yeah, fine, okay. Fine. So what do we say? You just mandate me to listen to the content. We move that to an observation. Right? I will draft all the amendments, right? So don't do anything until you come back. So can we then move on to the last section, GPAA?
Yeah. feedback on some of the things that we have picked up as a committee.
Can I just remind members, by the way, remember the reasonable output. The minister has to reply right. So we do get, unlike your MPDCS report, in terms of the money bills act, the minister has to have a written reply. And we distributed these last year's reply when we were looking at this year. So there's no difference there. Fine, I'll write to you. But I mean, there's no need to. What I'm saying, you are right. In the committee, we don't discuss deadlines. We ask you to make recommendations. We gave you two deadlines to do it. No member wrote to us. So then we, Antonio, where's the team? Antonio, Dorian, Goni, myself, and the two secretaries sat together five questions. And then we worked over the weekend and got it done. So, I mean, there's no difference in policy. It's a problem. I mean, he has to have a written reply. In fact, we agree it was you that put the issue on the agenda.
I don't know the problem. It's common cause now that there is no proper foundational document of the deep past. But then if they were an African report now and an independent report, then we can then give a directive that the government issues in Japan must put in proper place and the proper board, but in the same way the GPS has or PSC has. We should oversee the activities of the branch, not in the manner in which it is now. But another board which has got nothing to do with the power, but has to address the minister about what happens in the fight. It's a wrong framework. So we can take a resolution that let us normalize the governance issues in the power. And then another thing that will be difficult about that, so that there's then a framework of how that we are going to achieve this.
Does anybody
want to
respond to that? Can I suggest that's not a decision we need to do? So what we are asking, why is it the way it is? From what we can tell, it doesn't seem to be consistent with corporate governance or the PFA. All the things you said, but we haven't taken a decision that it needs a specific or that it wants to severe in its current links. That's something that's an outcome. We are merely asking for, right now, information. And explanation. It is only in March next year that we might take a decision that now this is how we want it done. But I think it's preempting it. It's fine enough. You see, the minister has to reply in writing anyway. So I don't think, Floyd, there is any difference between your concern and the rest of the committee. However, you already made a decision about how you want this matter addressed. And I think in fairness to us, until we hear from, I'm sure Momo's got a million explanations. I don't know about why it is like this and so on. Once we hear them, we might agree that the people might say, no, we understand in this specific circumstances, it's fine as it is, but we want to introduce certain qualifications. For example, how you decide to give performance bonuses and the like. I know Momo is itching to reply. Okay, fine. So can we leave it the way this is?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Then I want to then ask for a mover and seconder. Become alive to somebody who's going to move and second if the hands are up. Rupert Thorne is here, deputy for the sec. Welcome, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just record our objection.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Deputy for the second. We record it as a matter of fact.
Okay.
It's boring. And, can you do it? Write him a letter. Deputy for the Secretary General, yeah. Financial Stability Board, Bank for International Settlement Council. Now, you've got a team, right? Is that right? It's been distributed? So in that case, can we hand over to you? Momo, you might want to say a few preliminary. Before we do, let us welcome you. I believe you have a conference in Cape Town.
There's a normalizing issue which was raised when GPS and PSC spoke about free education and what mechanisms and different things. I don't see it reflected.
I don't
it
know what
the
issue was.
No. It is on... In fact, you also the one that you're saying, the 2 point whatever.
Yeah, the 2.5% proposition.
Oh, I thought you were saying
About giving 2.5%.
Yeah, I know that. I just
want
to ask going to
the report. I don't know. It's part of the presentation. Like some of the issues that were raised about CIC are reflected here. Yeah. But the one that we spoke about, teacher education, is not here. I don't think.
Yeah, well, let me to the vision. I mean, remember that we ask people to make notes. So I use my notes, and I'm telling you, I'm going to use their notes. It's quite possible that we agreed on that. Because people remind me, I know what your view is about 2.5. What did you ask of the PIC?
What we have requested from both GPS and PIC,
yeah.
Mostly GPS, because they own the money, is that they the consideration of having 2.5% of all the pension funds set aside for the financing as part of the intervention for free education.
I don't remember that as a position that we took. I remember that as a question being asked. So then we come into the question. But if that's a position of the committee as a whole, I don't know how you're arriving to that. If you were saying that the PIC should consider the implications of that proposal you have, that may be something the committee can consider as part of various proposals on how we provide the free education. But if you think it's the position of the committee that they do that, that's separate. You don't agree on that. So what are you exactly asking?
That is, that is part of the submission that has been made, that is not to consider. That is why you can say that it's not to consider that. GPS or PIC must consider that for the nature of the 2.5 contribution. They can take their own decisions in terms of how this can happen. They have spent money in material and quality on water. They spend money on many other things as well. Like they've given 6 million grants to save loan mean from liquidation. They've recently spent 9.4 billion rands on buying 2.7% shares in Spain.
So
there are so many things. So that is part of the things that is part of the broad mandate that can be looked into. Could be the whole issue of the education crisis that is confronting society now. And as an important role player in this field, they can say they should play a performance on the report. And actually, like, all the other additional issues change. So, we can a somewhat more substantial submission about that and actually bring it to the
attention. The appropriations
committee I think Honorable Shivam was correct on what he said. That is exactly what the president was saying. But we have not had an opportunity as a committee to discuss and come to the table. There are many other issues that were raised, and we agree that all these GEPA, GEPF, FIC, all those things that we have raised, which most of them or some of them are not captured in the report, they have to respond in writing. And then after that is when that we can get into that. But also I think Honorable Shibambu missed an opportunity on Wednesday when the funding model was presented by PDO. So I think we should have discussed today and throw in these other ideas. But I think we still have time to speak about it. It was not according to me, or if my memo still tells me, well, it was not a resolution that we agreed on.
I don't remember either. Go ahead, speak Jenna.
No, Chair, I think if you look at what Comrade or Honorable Shivam was indicating last week, it was a proposal that he was putting across TIC and then to say, how about you considering Manchester? And immediately they also responded that our mandate is different, but we know what you're saying, and they can go back and do all the things. And where I'm sitting here, I had thought these are some of the proposals that we have to put in the basket on the bigger discussion engagement that is currently taking place. If you look at 5.14 of what we are saying as a committee, that National Treasury, our committee, the portfolio committees on higher education and all those things, to continue to engage on sustainable way of dealing with matters of higher education. I think this is another opportunity where Comrade Floyd can still take the process forward and make it as a proposal when we go there anyway. But it can't be the position of the committee to say this is what you are saying to DEPA or to GPF or to PS. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think you're coming to another. What we are saying is we don't have a view, we're not opposed to it. It's one of issues in the basket of issues, right? Tomorrow the MTBP is might be a funding. The appropriation, I'm sorry for our committee as well, but the appropriations committee is primarily covered that now. So we won't, when we meet on that issue, we'll meet jointly with them, as we did last week. But that's not a reason we said no to it, but it can't be even about considering because of the position. We don't actually know the implications. You've done work in that area. You've got a long document. You take your funding to the research unit and yourself have done it. But we don't know where the issue is. We don't know. So, you know, as normally happens, if there's questions around which there's no recommendation, we don't take it forward in a report. Right? So thank you for that, Floyd. I don't think we're opposing it, we're not supporting it. Sorry, I apologize for that. Okay, sir, can I hand over to you? Basically, to explain, we're under a lot of pressure. And time-wise, I mean, we got in the late yesterday afternoon, as you hear, at the moment, that's what we said. Given that we are, in fact, looking at what we call the 22 spots, we thought it's appropriate for us to come back. So we're suggesting, if we may, be 20 minutes or so of an input, 20 minutes or so of an input. Okay, so can I hand over to you?
Yes, sir. Look, I think without much further ado, I think, as you said, Rupert Thorn, I think, is the Deputy to the Secretary General of the Financial Stability Board. He's talked about what this body does. It's a multilateral body, mainly G20 countries and others, financial centers, and what happened is, and in fact, the Governor and myself, we represent South Africa, we have two seats on it. And what they do is they're not standard setters themselves, but they bring together all your regulatory agencies and standard setting bodies. So they bring the regulatory bodies from the G20 countries, mainly central banks or the bank regulators, insurance regulators. And they also bring together the Basel Committee, the Insurance Committee, IOSCO. They don't actually do the standards themselves, but they kind of Rupert can tell us more how they sort of bring together and harmonize these proposals. Certainly since the 2008 financial crisis, this body has taken the lead. It's chaired currently by the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. Rupert, over to you. And we just thought it would be good to see what steps this body has taken to lead in dealing with the 2008 global financial crisis.
Before we are going to introduce Charles here, he's the chairperson of the second book, Financial Council of Promise.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and everyone for making time for me today. I'm in town for a meeting of the FSB Regional Consultative Group for Sub-Saharan Africa, where we take the opportunity to get feedback from many of the countries in the region on the FSB policy reform, and this is a really excellent opportunity for me, so thank you again, and especially for the short notice. Mara has described some of the background of the FSB, other FSB, your own FSB here in South Africa, so I won't go into that in detail, other to note a couple of points here. So we grew out of a body that was formed in 1999, back in the Asian financial crisis, when authorities felt that many of the warning signs for that Asian financial crisis, if you remember that back at the time, were known at the time, but people were not joining up the dots. Ministries of finance understood some of the fiscal issues. Supervisors understood the issues in the balance sheets of banks. Central banks were looking at the monetary situation, but features were not being put together. So the Financial Stability Forum was put together, like the Financial Stability Board is now, to bring together those different bodies in the administration. It was relaunched following the financial crisis in 2009 to broaden the membership out from the G7 from the advanced economy membership to the 2020. So there's roughly an equal balance of advanced economies and emerging markets in the it worked for a three-stage process, which is the top of the slide there. Joint diagnosis of problems, then policy development and coordination, and monitoring and follow-up on implementation. It's all on a voluntary basis, setting voluntary minimum standards, and we're a coordinating body primarily. Membership here notes that the individual sectoral standard sectors are all part of the FSB, the banking standard sector, insurance, security. Wherever something is specific to those sectors, we defer to that sectoral body as the standard sector. Where it's, we help coordinate, and where there are cross-cutting issues, we help in setting standards there. A reminder of the jurisdiction representation, where we have an addition to the country beyond the G20, a small number of major international financial centres around the world to make sure we're covering the main cross-border issues. Our organisation, we have about 70 members in the 24 jurisdictions and the international organisation. There are two members from South Africa, representing the central bank, and another international treasury. The plenary is the decision-making body for all policy. The steering committee steers the work, and government in Yargo is on that. And we have the freestanding committee corresponding to the three-stage process for assessing vulnerabilities, cooperating in setting supervisory standards, and then the crucial monitoring of take-up of those standards. We have the working, and the recent consultative group that I mentioned I'm actually here and take cover. We're reporting to the G20, but we're not a G20 body, we're a self-standing organisation. And we're also based in Basel in Switzerland. It's very much a member-led body, not a staff-led body. Boom before the crisis had been fueled by excessive and mismanaged debt, built over a long period of seemingly benign macroeconomic conditions. While there have been concerns prior to the crisis about excessive credit growth and opaque risk transfer, neither authorities nor market participants, to be honest, had appreciated the extent of the risks that were building up in the financial system. And we had a system where many banks were significantly undercapitalized and underfunded relative to the risk they ran. And that was particularly the case in the largest and supposedly the best informed financial. financial markets in the world, that North America and Europe. So when the crisis hit, core markets seized up, the effects were transmitted across the globe, including a seizing up of US dollar wholesale funding. Emerging markets suffered from overextended globally operating banks who suddenly pulled back their activity, and there was a loss of confidence that was only halted in the end to authorities in the major jurisdictions backstopping the system with public funds. And here results on the screen. Public debt in the wake of the crisis, particularly in France, there was a sharp fall in GDP growth, and in fact a recession in the advanced economy. That lost activity has never been recovered. Unemployment remains at much higher levels in advanced economies, although emerging markets have made good progress in the period since then, partly due to the growth in China. So, it was clear that a coordinated response was needed across all the major financial jurisdictions, given the global nature of the crisis, and in order to preserve the benefits of an open and integrated system and a level playing field. And the involvement of policy areas, different policy areas across different national authorities and standard settings was warranted, which fitted the membership of the EC. Such a process of joint diagnosis of problems and coordinated policy development has been underway since 2008. It involved the intense collaboration of the member countries of the FSB, and those member countries, they account for 85% of global GDP and 90% of financial system assets. So really, if they can sort out their issues, it's going to be an enormous driver for the global economy as a whole recovery. And those reforms, as the slide shows here, cover are centered around four main areas: making financial institutions more resilient, that's primarily about capital and ending duties to fail and costs for the public that arise when duties to fail firms have to be burned out. Making derivatives markets safer so it can reduce inflation risk, and transforming shadow banking into resilient market-based finance. I just want to say a word on shadow banking. It's a somewhat emotive term. The FSB's view is not that shadow banking is a bad thing. It's shadow in the sense that it is bank-like activity that is taking place outside banking regulation. So where it creates a systemic risk, as banking activity in their formal sector as well, it needs to have protection in the same way as regulation of the banking system. So that's the big picture. Just to talk a little more in detail about these different things. As I mentioned, the core of the reforms has been rebuilding the resilience of financial institutions, and that's been the so-called Basel 2.5 report and Basel 3. Many banks entered the crisis too little capital and liquidity in relation to the risks that they were running and that they were posing on their customers. And much of the capital that they held was in fact not real loss-absorbing capital. In fact, despite the headline Basel II capital requirements, the actual minimum common equity was 2% of risk-weighted assets. Some of the banks in Europe and North America were running at that level of loss absorbing capital, too little to cover the risk that they were running. So it's been necessary to improve standards, to materially improve the quality, quantity, international consistency of minimum capital requirements, and to further protect against pro-cyclicality in the system. The Basel III reforms, the main aspects of them, were endorsed by the G20 in 2010. All the member countries of the Basel Committee have now issued their final regulations. There are also further measures being taken in terms of the finalisation of the level threshold to go guard against gaming, the risk of exposure. And for the first time ever, international liquidity standards. So there are common, there's a common minimum buffer to liquidity. The work's not finished yet, as the slide shows. The leverage ratio requirements have been fine. In fact, it might be early 2017, the leverage ratio. The work on improving consistency and comparability of capital is still taking place in the Basel Committee to ensure there's a level playing field without further increasing overall capital levels that are beyond those that have already been accepted. There are issues around how to properly enhance the sovereign exposures in their rule, which is still being grappled with, and the assessment of compliance. Ending too big to fail. So this is another key reform priority. One of the key lessons of the crisis is that when the largest financial institutions encounter problems, authorities in the past have had few alternatives but to put public money into solvency so that ordinary people are paying for the mistakes that the largest institutions made. This intensifies moral hazard risk, it distorts incentives, and most importantly, it can be disastrous for public finances. The lack of an alternative to saving interest rates needs to be corrected. And so there's a range of powers and tools that have been agreed to minimum international standards to address this according to three pillars, as you see here. And these are the three pillars were set out in 2010, and they've been the standards have been subject to no guidance in effect. First, and really the most important pillar, is a standard that enables even the largest firm to be credibly resolved without the need to put in public funds and without subjecting to disruptive effects. So the FSB has set out a minimum international standard, the key attributes of effective resolution, that is being implemented by the different FSB members. It sets out overall key attributes for the financial system as a whole in terms of recovery and resolution plans, the vital issue of how to cooperate across borders in resolution, which you'll remember was one of the key problems that Lehman Brothers faced and which led to contagion across the global financial system, and the importance of assessments to resolve derivative banks. The final point there is on total loss absorbing capacity, that there is an alternative place where the losses, which do inevitably exist when an institution fails, can be absorbed by on the balance sheet rather than by the That work is ongoing to provide further guidance. Only last week we issued further guidance on the application of these key attributes in the banking sector based on country experience today. So that's one leg, credible resolution regime. But it's important in something like ending too big to fail to have a belt and braces approach, and probably an extra pair of braces as well, given the potential effects. So additional pillars are higher loss absorbency within the largest financial institutions. These have been set out as minimum standards for global systemically important banks. There are principles for national economies to establish for their to set their own rules for systemically important banks. And there's further work being done in other sectors such as the insurance. The third pillar, more intense supervision. I won't go into this in detail, but there's
going to be what it's going to be.
Apologies, there's a lot of acronyms. SIFIs are systemically important financial institutions.
No, by now we know.
That's very good. Of which they have SIBs and SIIs and MBNI SIFIs. More intense supervision. We've set out in working with the Basel Committee some guidance in this area for
for more intensive supervision of civic, including the crucial question of getting better data with which supervisors are able to monitor. The derivative market. So this was again, you can recall Lehman Brothers and AIG as key transmitters of the financial crisis through their derivatives. It's very important to reduce the contagion risk that the previously largely unregulated over-the-counter derivatives markets were creating in the system. The G20 agreed five commitments, big picture commitments in this area. Improve transparency by making sure that all over-the-counter derivatives are reported to trade repositories, so the information available to regulators and in aggregate form the public. All standardized derivatives should be subject to central clearing so that the contagion risks can be reduced through that central clearing. There should be capital and margining requirements, both for the central clearer and for transactions that don't go into central clearing to further reduce those contagion risks. Organize platform trading to make them more like exchange-traded derivatives, which function very well during the crisis and have a very solid system of transparency and management. And to increase standardization so that derivatives are more transparent, more of them can be centrally cleared. Those are the big picture goals. This involves a lot of intensive work because it started from a much earlier base than the banking system, which already had international standards. There were no international standards for the derivatives market. So these have been built up more gradually over time in terms of principles for the financial market infrastructures, in terms of guidance on trade repositories and central clearing. The work to make central clearers more robust through recovery and resolution guidance, because it is vital. By trying to reduce the too big to fail risk of derivative market participants, these risks are being transferred into the central counterparty. So by definition, really, and by intent, those central counterparties are now, if you like, too big to fail institutions by design. We have to make sure that they can also, if necessary, be recovered or resolved without cost to the public. And so recovery and resolution guidance is being developed in cooperation with the relevant standard setters. We will be finalising that guidance with the standard setters over the next 6 to 12 months. We're also continuing to work on resolving the cross-border issues which inevitably arise in this market when the two counterparties to a derivative transaction are in different jurisdictions. And when the reality for a country like South Africa is that many of the derivative transactions done by institutions in this country are with US and EU counterparts, and therefore they are subject, those transactions, to the rules of the US and EU. How do we make sure that the rules that South Africa sets can be compatible with the rules that US and EU set that need to apply to the same transaction, but there's a counterparty from each side? That's work that we're continuing to help facilitate, and we had a helpful workshop in this area, bringing advanced economies and emerging markets together just earlier this month that Roy Hartman came and presented on the South African system. Shadow banking, I mentioned it earlier, it's not in itself a bad thing, but it needs to make sure that where there are prudential risks, those risks are managed with the same degree of vigilance as if they took place in the banking system. There are five areas of focus here. First, shadow banking links into the banking system. This is a key source of contagion from the so-called spheres and conduit and structured investment vehicles of the crisis, to make sure that those interactions with banks are properly understood by supervisors and that banks they're covered in that prudential regulation. That work is largely covered already through the Basel Committee. Money market funds. These are shadow banks in the sense that people who put money into them, retail investors, corporates, they treat them like deposits. The funds are secure and in their mind, and they can withdraw them on demand. That's very much like a bank deposit. So the risk of a run on those money market funds needs to be protected against. The relevant standard setters have set out standards in this area to reduce the run risk. Securitization, I mentioned the sieves and conduits and all these acronyms during the financial crisis. We now have standards for putting securitization on a more transparent basis that better make sure that securitization is able to fund the real economy and not simply create artificial financial assets. Securities lending and repo is another important area where contagion can take place because of the short-term liquidity risk in those markets. There's more transparency now, more common minimum standards on margining. And then there are, I'd say, other shadow banking entities there. There are many other forms of potential bank-wide risk that need to be managed. Microfinance institutions, deposit takers other than banks. It's important where those prudential risks, that the prudential regulation manages with a similar degree of vigilance to the banking system. So that's the shadow banking work. On the screen, you can see the current priorities and work plan for this year and next. I could go on for a long time, but I won't do it this day. So I'm happy to take any questions or comments on our work.
Sorry,
you
do a visit I might be intrusive, and if we'd known before, when you're on next time, we'll more let us know the time.
Yeah.
And we'll avoid flooding us. Thank you very much for that. Gives the good feel. We've been looking at your documents, by the
when something is not consistent, it's very ordinary when we come.
No, it's you who doesn't come.
No, you got a much better record than him. Yeah. Fine, this is amazing.
Thank you, Peter. For the exposure, just, I would like to hear your comments on two things. As long as you are having too big to fail, the risk that you are saying we are trying to manage of not using public funds to say this will forever be there. So what you are comment other people are saying, rather than dealing with the two risks, none too big to fail, let's rather say there should be no too big to exist. What's your comment on it? Too big to exist, let's deal with it at that level. Not when you are dealing with it, and there is very little that you can do when a big financial institution is going under. You must use public funds to try and save it, to try and avoid the contagion. I want to hear your comment. Secondly, looking at the regulation of these very complicated financial institutions, for example, if you take the OTCs derivatives, it's a very complicated structure. What has happened to the cost of regulation? I think it should have skyrocketed. But what is the experience? I think those are the two things that I would like to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I also want to weigh in on this phenomenon of too big to fail.
But saying, if you look at most emerging markets or financial markets that are still relatively underdeveloped, you find that the financial system would be bank-based rather than market-based. So it faces a different set of risks. Have you identified any vulnerabilities in the systems, let's say, for example, between the different institutions, you know, more established ones, and the emerging markets? And what are those issues, and how, what steps are you going to take to try and mitigate them? Because emerging markets, as you know, would face a different set of risks as opposed to those that are well developed. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terrific meeting. Nice to have you with us. In the work that you do, what is the kind of reaction? Is there a great deal of consensus, or do you have to encourage people to follow the kind of line that is believed to be the best? And here in South Africa, I would like to hear. I mean, we think we do quite well. Just a short comment about how well we are doing, and whether we can in fact kick the pin peak school to touch for another year or two, so if we can go play a bit more golf.
Yeah. Any more questions?
I don't know if he understands my sense of humour. That the last one really doesn't need a response.
Sorry, we call each other by first names.
Nobody ever understands this humour. Nobody's what? Okay, now let's ask you two quick questions. It's overlapping about Mr. Fonkwa, which is to say that why how do you respond to people who say that largely the work of the financial stability board and related institutions is pitched too much on the basis of the needs and conditions in the developed world? They're not sufficiently sensitive to this continent, this country, for example, and so on. Speaking of the peculiarity of what we call the political skills, whatever the meaning of some form or more of politics, which is post 2008, and who ultimately bears the cost. Our concern is the consumers. You know, you introduce a whole lot of provisions for the banks to abide by, regulatory and other, and the cost that they have to bear is substantially suggested, borne by the consumers. And again, disproportionately will be the poorer. And of course, in a country like ours with extreme inequality, it's particularly acute. So, what's your response to that? You may not want to. Are you familiar, finally, in a brief response to what you said? Are you familiar with our twin peaks? So, what do you think is coming forward? I'm not going to go through you, but you know, you can bring this to attention to you, and if you want to respond, fine.
Let me start with too big to fail. We're committed in the FSB, and my chairman is very strong in saying to end too big to fail, not to ameliorate too big to fail or reduce the consequences of too big to fail, but to end. And it's a resolution regime and realistic resolution plan for each individual institution are at the core of that. Now, there are a range of views around the world on whether this is the government to break up the largest banks, to separate retail banking and investment banking. Reality is in the FSB, we have a range of jurisdictions around the table. They have different views. We are setting minimum agreed standards, not imposing one form of financial system in a one-size-fits-all way around the world. So what has been agreed as a minimum standard is to create the resolution, the legal resolution plan, the higher loss absorbency, the more intense supervision to make sure all so-called too big to fail banks can be safely resolved if needed. Time will tell whether that is the case. We're not there yet by any means. Cross-border agreements in particular need
obviously going around the same issue, which is, are we taking account of the cost of the additional regulation and compliance surrounding it? The first point to note is that the cost of crisis, the global financial crisis, was very large indeed. I showed the increase in debt, the reduction in GDP, the green cost benefit analysis. It's very important to recognise that there were massive costs that in many parts of the world are still coming up almost a decade later, which in the view of the FSB justify a significant increase in the regulation of the system. Having said that, of course, it's very important to make sure that regulations and compliance are the right standards and measures, and in particular that they're proportionate to the size and sophistication of financial institutions and risk they pose. The individual standard setters are trying to take these things into account in their own impact studies and at national level as part of cost benefit analysis that take place. Over the last 2 years, we've been putting a much greater emphasis, I didn't have time in my talk here, on assessing the implementation and particularly the effects of reform to start to analyse these things in a more consistent framework. We're going to set out the framework by the middle of next year for consistently looking at the effects of reform, and we welcome input from countries like Canada who can do that. But I'm not saying the cost of regulation definitely. Compliance costs are up. There's no question about that. And to some extent, it was an intended emerging markets the extent to which we're taking capital here have a slide here that I didn't have time to get to. So the crisis that much of the work of the last few years has been directed towards was a crisis of the making in the largest advanced financial market. And therefore, the onus was on taking measures that would address the problems that they had created and they had exported to the rest of the world. So the initial steps that were taken were to address toxic assets, to address sophisticated derivatives markets, to address forms of shadow banking that probably don't exist here in South Africa and never did, were understandably directed at those short-term problems to try and address them at source. At the same time, international standards are things which are agreed throughout the FSB, the G20, and where they're taken up by the Basel Committee or IOSCO, even by the different countries. So it's important that those minimum standards be applicable across the different countries. That's part of the discussion that we have in the FSB to make sure that the objectives are the same across countries in terms of the degree of protection, but that implementation is proportionate across different jurisdictions. Now that's easier said than done. And what I mentioned, the workshop we had earlier this month on derivative reform, to actually bring the emerging market derivative regulators to the table, together with the US and EU regulators, so that we can hear about the challenges that derivatives markets are facing, the very real capacity challenges, that challenges in understanding what is going on in the US and EU, and their very complex rulemaking and politics and so forth. That's part of the role we're playing here. I mean, I also want to emphasize that the standards that are set within the FSB are standards that we're expecting to be applied by the FSB jurisdiction. And we're not saying the countries beyond the FSB jurisdiction, it's true, because they're not at the table to agree to them. We're not saying that they are committed to implement. But South Africa is at the table of the FSB and has agreed that has agreed to the minimum standards. I think as the work goes forward, we're increasingly focusing on issues which are less about fixing the past crisis, they're more about ongoing macro prudential policy and issues that affect emerging markets, such as the decline in correspondent banking, which is affecting very much the ability to send remittances around the world. That's been a major focus of our discussions this week, a major focus of the FSB agenda. On consensus, the FSB operates by consensus. We have no voting share, not like the IMF or the World Bank, where they're appropriate. We only agree a policy when, by consensus, everyone around the table has agreed that they can live with it. What makes that work is that it's a peace game, that people realize that there's times when they have to show a little bit of flexibility in reaching that consensus, because there'll be another issue a little while longer where they're going to want their counterparts across the table to show consensus. I'm sure it's much like Parliament. You never get anything done if nobody's prepared to find a compromise. But it is done, but if a country says it can't live with something, then it's not agreed within the FSB. We don't override anything. So, the Twin Peaks Bill, I step into this very much under the control of we did a country, we do country peer reviews to look at selected issues in all the member countries of the FSB. We did one a year or two back on South Africa, and one thing we focused on was the Twin Peaks. Now, we recognize, our members recognize, that different countries have different approaches to the overall framework of financial regulation and financial stability. And we're not trying to impose a one size fits all. Some countries are going down the Twin Peaks model. Some countries continue to have segregated supervisors across different sectors. Some have gone for an integrated supervisory review. And the FSB hasn't taken a view which of those is better or worse. There are different views around the table. And indeed, I think the state of knowledge hasn't been good enough. So there are some basic principles that I think we set out in the peer review and suggested one or two aspects here. Part of it is streamlining to try and consolidate functions within the Twin Peaks and reduce the number of separate bodies involved. It's just a suggestion. There are other countries like the US where we've made this suggestion and they've declined to act, for instance, on the SEC and the CFTC having a splitting of the securities and commodities regulation world. We're not the first people to suggest that in the US and we won't be the last. So it's a suggestion based on technical experience. Another aspect is the importance of setting a clear legislative mandate at the outset and a clear process and procedures for cooperation, because experience suggests from other countries that if you just set these up in an ad hoc way and you hope that that people will understand that again when the crisis happens, confusion and passing the buck can arise. So those are some of the general principles, but not trying to micromanage the principles. So
are you going to be an
not for the mini. I am around for our regional consultancy group meeting is continuing until lunchtime. I'm going to have a 6 p.m. class.
I'm just asking, more will you be here in the parliamentary briefing?
You're
not sure. Alright, so maybe you take that to the agenda. Thank you for apologize.
Just to mention that I often get asked by the institution, the facilities and trust, and they often get paid as well.
Okay.
And I don't normally go because it's in the time. So this time around, they asked me to speak on something which I like to be speaking about, it's citizen engagement. Now, just to explain, I used to be the vice president of this institution before I moved to the biggest group. So it partly explains why, it's quite connected. So they asked me to speak on citizen engagement. So if you look at pages 4 onwards, that's the speech I gave, right? I have 7 minutes to do that. And it's going to be published in the network and all that. So on. Explain, this is basically an institution of empathy. Let's say you can read this 3 pages. You can translate in a few
people.
Let's not discuss all that piece, right? I mean, in the World Bank, as it is, they have to have French and English speaking, right? So basically, let me explain to you what this organization is. It's actually a network of parliamentarians who try to hold the World Bank and IMF to account for their expenses. And I'm sorry that Floyd's not here. They can criticize us, you know. But when you go to that parliamentary network, quite frankly, we are least ahead. The greatest thing about all of us. I mean, we're the only social democratic real life country. So, lucky our conservative members of Congress are in the developing world. And frankly, when we were there, we shifted towards opening up the world by the climate and saying, oh, you can't go ahead and leave the government alone. So, in some senses, we've gone back. I'm not saying it's because of me as an individual. Sandy could have done the same thing, Pule, you could have done it. Anybody. Anybody from the ANC would have done it, actually. It's nothing about me personally. Right? It's about the values and traditions and perspective of the ANC as well. Never mind what's going on at the moment, let's talk about the real ANC, right? So, in short, I'm just saying, in some sense, it's become better. So, the participants are explained in 2122. This is a smaller workshop. They have a conference every now and then. Workshop where they restrict the numbers. So it's much more productive. The major issues raised were, if you look at 3.9, global outlook on growth and jobs, energy subsidies, good governance, corruption, citizen engagement, migration, displacement and conflict, healthcare, and the role of the IGA. We don't actually take money. It doesn't affect us. The IGA allocates World Bank money to the poorest countries. Of course, much of what was said fitted in what Christine Lagarde said, and that's how you say her name. She said, and I quote, that the global economy is still weak and fragile, and global growth, I like this, global growth is too low, for too long, benefiting subsidy. So that's where you're putting it, right? And the new mediocre is the environment of low growth, low inflation, low interest rates, right? So there, easily you can read through that. They know just what's going on in the world, the sort of things you're familiar with. 3-4, sorry?
Yeah. Yeah. What's the relevance of that?
3.4, they note the advances made in the last 10 years in the developing world. 3.5, this is concerning obviously, right? Moving towards a more protectionist regime globally. Suddenly people are now putting up barriers. They demanded of us, a certain deputy minister, former deputy minister of a certain department, no. Her department shot ahead of all the WTO requirements, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And look at our textile industry right now.
Uh-huh.
A certain former Minister of Finance is
yeah.
for
guys,
it. Mm-hmm. Right? But let's not discuss this.
Yeah, I'm
easy. I've got nothing to do with claims of argument.
You hear what
Ngongo
is saying? We are going forward with
3.6. Okay, and it's 3.7, reducing corruption. 3.8 is on citizen engagement, to which I responded, the World Bank thing. And then, obviously, it's a very painful thing that you see on our TV screens all the time, right? The migration and displacement of people from Syria and elsewhere. On the value of the workshop, the chairperson, Mr. Jeremy LeFroy, suggested that MPs support IGA replenishment, doesn't apply to us. They begin involved in chapters of the parliamentary network. Of course, yes, we've been asked to write a paper on that. I don't know how much time I said September.
or this contribution I made in saying anything to this issue that's coming up. Now, unlike the conferences, this is a smaller workshop, but it's much more productive. Right? The standard of engagement is much higher now than the previous term there before 2009. The aim of the workshop is mainly to hear about the World Bank climate policies, programs and projects, and also MPCC. The key aim is to empower MPs so that we can be more effective in our oversight and legislative growth. There's also a focus on MPs being more accountable to citizens and ensuring more public participation. And then 4.4, I think more should be done, really. For example, on the citizen framework engagement, did everyone consult the parliamentary network? Yes, they invited me to make a response to it. So I said, well, why don't you actually come to us before you shape the framework in the first instance? 4.5, interestingly, there was no discussion about the new development bank. And I think that's a matter that I'll put on the agenda, because you can't just look at the IMF and World Bank. Let's look at the new development banks as well. Interestingly, no discussion about the reform of the Bretton Woods institutions. Again, we put the issue on there. 4.6. Although MPs go there, like I went there to make an input. I didn't have a mandate on the finance commission. I was discussing that. But I mean, really, we should have some sort of action plan that emerges at the workshop. Because it costs so much to fly people to Washington for 8 hours. And we don't have an action plan. So I have started engaging with the chairperson, Mr. Leroy, who's a British MP, chairperson of the International Relations Network. It mainly includes finance. The chairperson of finance and other MPs are in finance. So why? Because I think they deal with international development aid from the UK. So this is ODA, I think.
Yeah.
No, very few people actually from the country. This is not an open country. They invite certain other people. I'm just saying, if you go to this country,
it's like there's different talent.
With due respect, I can understand how our international relations minister also, you know, take people. I just see if you look. Let's leave it at this. Yeah.
Are you really still hopeful about those two institutions?
No, no, no. We must hold them to account because of their power. I have no illusion. But I'm just saying, don't underestimate how MPs elsewhere in the world will not even ask for this. Civil society does. The Kenyan or the Kenyan civil society activists. This is the thing. Civil society people are all the same. And I've been trying to sit there. And some of them even said, you know, we wish our MPs were like that. But something I'm not doing. Actually, most of the MPs from the majority party, some of them from the other parties, do the same thing. Nothing here that I'm saying that an average MP, I just happen to be chairing the committee. Yeah. And I've a part of the committee. Actually, civil society, really, after the comes to some conference again, and wanting to stay over for the rest of 2 days, I couldn't do all that.
We should have a discussion about financial institutions there. We should have been discussed in our own African Development Bank.
Yeah.
Like the ICC.
When are they going to take Tony Blair?
No, you know, I've heard that. Anyway, because the international outlook of who you were as an international problem is going to be, you know, but it's a debate for another day.
Yeah.
We need to look at it.
Now, we don't vote on this report. It's not just here reporting back. Is any questions? I spoke to the president. He said, no, you don't vote.
Chair, I think you represented us very well. Our view. But as you know, that the ANC and the opposition have been involved in the from their inception, and there hasn't been much a movement. I think talking about the things that we're talking about 30, 40 years ago, that's why my question, and for me it's also very telling that nothing was said about the Big Bang. And you know very well that it is the concern of the IMF and so on. That's why the Big Bang is always saying that we're not replacing the IMF, wants to work with them. I think when we get into those international fora, that's why we should start talking about how do we cooperate. Because as you know how the space is made up. Please understand the emerging economy challenges far better than anybody else in the IMF or the World Bank. And by coordination and so on. Yeah, exactly. But all right, I'm saying that they can't have these conferences and not talk about how do you make that work. Because you know there's an extreme who says who wants to replace the threatened institutions with the Big Bank, and therefore some of the stances which will be taken by the West. And then the other extreme, perhaps from us, I say forget about the World Bank, just form our own thing and so on. I'm sure the answer is somewhere in the...
Yeah, I think they're on the same page. Can I pass on for this? It's not something you can do much about.
And Chair, I don't even know why we have to be apologetic about it. Why did you want me to replace them so much? They must up their game. It's not a problem.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. Can I just say something else that I need to brief you about? Because I don't know where this is going. Can I just get attention? We need to move on, but I need to brief you. Some members of this committee already know that you are serving on a structure that the other person who went to this meeting, the speaker gets invited to this parliament. So the speaker sent to this parliament. But Samuel Boroto is a member of the National Association. He has written to me, and you remember you were invited to that meeting, that workshop. No, nobody came. I was really used to look at all reports of people who participate in these conferences and come back. I explained to Comrade Borotho, it doesn't only include the middle, it cuts across areas. That actually, I'm not sure what we're supposed to do, because we don't have any say on who goes. None of us has ever been to any of these conferences. So how are we going to judge the report? So we're stuck there, but I will have to convene a meeting just for the sake of convening it. I think, Alf, you're on it, isn't it? And what is this? Maybe I'll send the notice out, you as the secretary of that committee, just to let you know, there is a committee called South African Parliament Committee on the New Development Bank. It is supposed to decide on what mandates people go with when they go to these conferences. And also there is a person report back to this committee, not this committee, this, which has many of these. Except that people go up and down, the speakers often decide on who goes. No one consults me or this committee. So I asked her last week, what do you want us to do? What are we supposed to convene about? We don't actually. And she explained to me what we're supposed to do. So those of you who are members of the committee are doing this. We'll have to convene a time on this. Just to report you, there is, by the way. But you are absolutely right. I'm sure I raised the issue. It wasn't there. And I've been engaging with them, and they're saying, no, correct. So for the next year, I think for the year after, whenever they meet again, they will actually have a swap to be said on the new development line. Although not much to report, they were still putting it on the head. Good. Thank you very much. Now to the rates and monetary bill. Now let me explain quickly. Momo will explain the answer. The rates and monetary bill have to be passed, usually, before we pass the other TELAB and TLAB. But this year, because of the local government election and the truncated parliamentary calendar, and because of other discussions, Treasury has not formally tabled. But strictly speaking, we have agreed that this bill, the rates and monetary bill, will be voted on at the end of June. That's like what more usual. This year, I have checked with everybody. I think we should try, but we can't vote on it today. I thought it's going to be tabled tomorrow. But as happens with these bills, we get informal receipts of bills and more or less finish the informal process today. And then we will vote on the bill the first day. We can even vote on it next week on the day, right? So we will go through everything and we'll prepare a report. I have started preparing a report in consultation with Treasury, and I want to look at it. I'm sending a copy now. Basically, we can't vote on the report, and I will email the report to you within 48 hours. You can start looking at it. So unfortunately, we can't vote on the call. The next thing to vote on is Kule Mave and myself, we let the one issue outstanding. You will recall we discussed this by several times. From what I know, there's no change between the earlier version that we finalized and this version that we have. Is that correct? So we'll try and find out.
I have to ask the person.
Department of Labor, DG, and the Department of Central and stuff like that. We need to follow up to come to the public hearing and make sure that it's funny. So that's been passed. But I'm not asking those committees, three of them, to come, otherwise you'll never get there. On environment, basically to summarize, their view is that they would have preferred, especially when you're chairman, to get a briefing from the minister and or DT and or the people on the issue. They didn't get it. So they feel they're not sufficiently conversant with the issues to say to us that, hey, guys, we disagree or we agree. So they feel that we should go ahead if we think it's appropriate, they accept that there's a money vote. But they will deal with the other outstanding conditions. They said, however, once they come to a condition, they will come back to us and say, well, if they have a problem, these are the problems we have. So they think it's technically correct to go ahead for us. I'm going to roll this person up. But they feel that they should, at least, they come back to us and say, guys, you've done the wrong thing. If that's the case, then you will have a joint committee. Fully, is that more or less the sum of your substance? I can't tell. I'm going to leave it out.
Mr. Chair, I think I have to agree with you. When we spoke to them, there was no fundamental difference at the rate. I think the part of their issues were mainly operational, which we said that they could always deal with those, that if they feel that we need to be attending to those things, they could always refer them back. But we felt that for the sake of demonstrating the governance regime, that it is important that we take this path. And then, you know, we can only learn because of what comes up with this process. And I think that is the approach and attitude to maybe take it in next week, informally raise it tomorrow, so that by the time we finish, because the date is now set for February, so it means we literally need to complete our process much sooner to give the Treasury and Environmental Affairs, there's also a structure called the Waste Management Bureau, so that the planning around those things could actually start happening in earnest now to make sure that there is no disruption to the industry as well.
And then the next thing to say is I did speak to Minister Edna Molewa to ask, not that it's something that we will hold by and say, oh, because the executive is in the airport, obviously not, but just to see, you know, we don't like the border management authority issue and the other situations we've confronted in the with the ministers, one of those in cabinet. And I'll talk to her last week. So, the issue that I dealt with by the rate and monitoring, she was not forward on the path. But the other issues she would deal with in the committee, the issues that appear before the committee, some things, issues about alternative options for the visa and so on. Now, if I am correct, you know, the legal challenge is not around whether this is something that should go to South or not. That's why they are, as you explained, they have to do with other issues that the environment department, the visa, and other stakeholders are pointing to. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair. Sorry. Yes. I think what we have been made to understand was that the ongoing legal dispute has been around Section 28 of the Waste Management Act, which largely deals with the tire rates. But as it relates to the rollout of a waste tire management plan, I don't think that has been an issue of dispute, which is what the environmental league seeks to solve. I think that is how we concluded it last week, unless I missed something.
Alright, is he right or wrong?
Yes, I think that's basically it. Yeah.
Good, fine. Yeah. Okay, let's move on. What are you unhappy with, Mr. Lee?
I'm not unhappy, I'm never unhappy, Mr. Chairman. I'm just unsure. So the bill as it's been proposed is we not in mainly. So in other words, the debate about whether it's a levy or a tax is now written.
You're a bit slow, but
you know, I
understand.
Chairman,
yeah,
I'm
not
here. If I would slow, at least I'm handsome.
You are not the only one. You are not the only one. Right. Now,
I suggest to the Commission that having done so much of work in the sense that we've done so much of work, I don't know whether we want to discuss the policy issues. Now, we covered them in the house. So I think, can we go through the clause by clause, informally, and we can't just follow the appropriate time. And can you quickly take us through the young? Is there any other matter, any other process, members feel we should pursue?
Chair, I think Yanga would remember, and I think even the Momo was there at some point. One of the things that we specifically raised, especially on the environmental levy, was to make sure that we try and avoid instances of a double taxation, where you find that manufacturers are still paying the other levy, and on the one side they are also paying the environmental levy. We said what this will do is that they will push the cost down to the consumer, you know. So just now, our handsome Mazamba now start buying 16-inch for his DTI for a higher price than you would have, because you need to also cover this part. So we just felt that the issue of double taxation should be dealt with, because that is the other possibility that we might find ourselves in if. It's between treasury.
Yes. Right. This one more. We covered here because there's a clear cut-off date, and that cut-off date has been communicated. There was the issue of retreads. We also dealt with the retread issue also. So.
Fine, but you've covered it. You already do.
And when you're finishing up, just do a paragraph. How about that? Good. Thank you very much.
Can you list out the issues that we raised as challenges, and then we are told how they've been dealt with, and then we will
look into
it.
But is there some specific issue you want to raise?
If I don't remember, it's maybe the rest remember, so I don't have to choose off the list in that list.
But is there a specific concern?
Yeah, not all the issues are there, like 1, 2, 3 issues.
No.
Okay.
Yes. I had thought, which I was agreeing with, that if we can have all those things, that we will consider not doing it again, as long as they are covered in the report of Antonio, then we will
then we should do it. Right, fine. Let's start then. All the issues we need to get. I think members want that.
Chair, what are those specific
that's
issues?
That's what I'm asking for. I'm not getting cooperation. Can the meeting as a majority?
Can I suggest something? Can I suggest that all those other issues that were mostly operational be referred back to the relevant portfolio committee of environment, because some of them were operational issues, if I remember, that they get settled at that level.
Double taxation is one of the things that
yes,
you want to hear.
Yes. Oh.
But how did you deal with it?
Can I respond to the double taxation issue?
I mean,
the double taxation issue was pretty clear that there's going to be a pretty cut-off date upon which the current fee collection will stop and the tax starts. So there's no double taxation. The other concern was on the retreads. And we have in the schedules specifically exemption for domestic retreads. Those were the two issues, Chair.
What are the issues that you want to raise? I'm not saying we want to discuss them. I just want to know what they are. Are there any other issues?
The point was not to be raised or be discussed. I was just clearly saying that's a document that shows that this is the issue that you raised.
Oh, no, we got it.
How they've been dealt with. And then, so that when by any chance this matter is revisited, you can always refer to them.
Yeah. That's what's in the report. I am telling you, we're working on a draft. These things are quite complex. I have worked on a draft. It's here, actually, but there's my computer. But can't I finish it? Because I want some advice on what the legal issues are. In another paragraph that fully has suggested. Remember, the draft is a draft. It gets sent to new colleagues. And you can't come here in the committee and read. People must just use the so we will actually, what we're going to do
I'm
is,
putting you on the stage.
Yeah, 48 hours, no, I understand. 48 hours from now, we will finalize the report for this. So you will get it, colleagues, latest Friday, Friday morning. So let's make it, by Friday, 12 o'clock, before I need an email. I have to deliver. I have to get cards, and they have to deliver. Can you just send me an email? And by 12 o'clock, I will get them the report. And they will reply by Tuesday, 12 o'clock. They will reply. Right, fine. Fine. I will do my job. And she has to do his or her job. I will do my job. By 12 o'clock, you will get a report. And by 12 o'clock on Tuesday, you will not decline.
You
We will work, right? These people think things fall from the sky. You know, they think we just leave this committee and then we go and talk in the corridor there about December 2017 or whatever affects us. Who's going to be the new leader of the 2019 coalition?
What is the relevance of
and who's going to be the cattle minister? You know, the fight will stop.
Then
you will see how
ANC
and you know,
and we've brought him back for you.
The
I want to say something very quickly. No, don't nod your head. Mr. Lee, Joe Scorbo's daughter, who is a writer and novelist, right? She first described the tensions between a leader and a deputy, right? This is on the eve of 2007. And in the last paragraph, she says, where do you think the distinction? South Africa, no. This is the conflict between Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. But the way she described it, right, you would have thought it's the cowboy
Clause 3 is just technical correction on the fixing on the, of the normal rate of tax. You remember the thing did not increase the new rate, but we just did the market. So it's clause 3 is just.
Okay, and this one on clause 3?
Yes.
You know, Gloria is not here. I'm trying to go through that. I will ask Frank to go through the first cover, meaning we do it the way we've done it before, colleagues. It is very difficult for MPs and for university. I've done some work with the usual parliament in the first year. They also have this thing, but they have a team of experts who are just going to check the prospects of things on. But from what I can tell, this matter also, we're familiar with it, right? Section 4.
Clause 4 is a technical correction where the F currently is 12 months ended. So we are just 12 months ended.
This one we've been through.
Oh.
Anybody wants to say anything?
12 months ending.
That's what it should be. 12 months. We were saying 12 months ending. The current act is 12 months ended. So we're making it.
Thanks, Pinky. Next one. 5.
Clause 1 is the increase in the primary rebate from 13,257 to 13,500.
Okay. 13,257.
Next one,
Clause 6 is the increase in the medical test credits based on the tables presented below.
Frank, you're going to go through this and check it on our behalf, together with the support of the secretary.
Medical test credits for individuals.
Yes, sir.
There's plenty of time, 2 weeks. Don't kill yourself. We're not going to vote on this. We'll let you give it up. Okay.
I'm just quickly run to the appropriations committee.
I know you will. When you leave here, you're always at work. I know that. You don't feel a hot
have you not seen
the third portion? Thank you. What do you think? Mazarbani is more loose than the sense of other person. Whoever had that elephant is
okay.
Excuse me. That's that we use it hard to say.
Okay, clause 7 deals with the increase in the capital gain tax for controlled foreign companies, because when you increase the capital gain tax, you have to do it across the board. So that deals with the increase in capital gain tax for controlled foreign companies. Clause 8 and 9, clause 8 deals with the increase in capital gain tax for long-term insurers. Clause 9 deals with the increase in capital gain tax for policyholder funds hold that are held by the long-term insurers in respect of the beneficiary.
Clause 10.
Clause 10 deals with the amount of exclusion, amount of inclusion for the residential accommodation as a fringe benefit tax.
Okay, here we. Okay, 11.
It is a fringe benefit.
Clause 10.
I don't want to deal with the issues, but I think we should
about moving house and things are going completely wrong. If I had the power, I would actually. And he has to be on leave yesterday. Can I also apologize to him? He was on leave yesterday to go home and consider what he was going to do with that later. So he got all the documents yesterday later, including that. But we wish him well. And so, Ellen, can I just say, come back when the letter is over. You work over weekends and so on. We owe you. They don't get overtime. We owe you a lot of time, Ellen, and your family. So quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, never mind the MPD here. What's going to happen is going to happen. Take the whole week off, as far as I'm concerned. Oh, it's here, and they'll get support. Please go. Thank you.
What's the challenge,
sir? I think it's personal thing, but it's a poor fellow that's been. It's a whole lot of crisis beyond his control. He's been phoning me, and he's been. I've been telling him to take the week off.
Okay.
I'm not dealing with the issue.
No, no.
I'm dealing with a human person here.
Yeah.
Who works very, very hard. You know?
Yeah.
And you find, where are the powers that be? Nobody's here. They must keep these people performance bonuses. The other committee sections don't perform. Why should a guy like Alan not get a performance bonus? It's not my problem. It's no, don't be out. Then you stay out of it. It's a collective problem of us.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with the him. This parliament must pay people who work so hard.
Yeah,
he
right.
was very hard. You have no idea. I ring him at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, as I did.
Make the bootshops do it.
No, these people must get paid properly.
Yeah. No, you're right.
He works very, very hard. He's an inspiration to me, really. And whoever takes over from here will discover it.
I'm voting for you, Chef.
No, I'm old enough now. I'm
voting for you, Chef.
Right. Number
where are you going?
11 now.
Where are you going?
Clause 12.1A deals with the CGT inclusion rate for natural persons. We are interested in it. And clause 12.1B deals with the insurance. We've done a similar provision in section 29 cap A and section 29 cap B. So we have to do it also in the capital gain cap A deal.
Any comments here? Okay, 13, my friend Younger.
Clause 13 deals with the customs and excise tax schedule, 13.1, and then 13.3, that's where the tire levy is, the introduction of the tire levy.
Mm. On pause here, any comments here, colleagues?
We are reassured that
the
government
is not. I will take
you through
the key points of the report
here.
In a moment, so you can guide me on what you want by Friday. Right. 14, please, Younger.
Okay. Clause 14 to 18 is the
end of the year. Yeah. We've covered this endlessly, right? I would like to read this properly. I haven't had a chance, right? So between Frank and me, we'll also look at the wording. Anybody else who can have the time? At least we've got to go through that. So on 14, can we just kind of pause here? I'd like to look at this carefully. Right? You have got the statement sent to you by Alan Osagoro, one of the sent on general changes you made. I think that's before your turn. It was sent about 2 months ago, right? And you've seen the changes in the report for what they've done. But I think we should go through that because a lot of us have been lobbied about this. We become these nerves now. On this one, I would like more time to be there. Frank and I will draw a bit for the employment. 16.
I said from clause 14 to
right
clause
through.
18.
Right.
Yes, it's a special voluntary.
I would actually, I'll find time over the weekend because I, you know, I got this late last night. I don't have time to do that. But I read the earlier stuff.
And the original implementation date was the 1st of October, and I saw an advert go out to that effect. Are we sticking with that and then making it retroactive?
Yeah. It seems that there's been articles in last week. I don't think it's because there's two articles explaining it in last week's paper. So we saw that. Okay, then where are we, Young?
And then now they're updating for the recent market.
Yeah, that's from page 14 onwards, right?
Page 14 onwards. I think the important page which goes to the tire levy, which we think is important, is on page 28. whereby the traded tires that are in South Africa, whereby zero on page 28, one, item 1520341, the heading the traded tires on page 28.
Okay, it's 28.
Page 20.
You don't have the schedule.
There's no page 28.
No, we do have the schedule.
There's a page 28.
I've got a page 28.
I have. Okay. Number 15.
From the top.
That's from the top.
Yeah, 152.
The
tire.
There is it. It's
yes.
00. On buses or lorries, on wagons and whatever, motor cars.
Right. So here, yeah, you're just confirming for us, I think.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Kule, you cool with it? Yeah,
no,
I don't own it. I don't
not
own
Kule.
It.
Ah.
No, what I mean is you've been, you know, making input for the training. That I want to do that.
No,
right,
is,
so can I ask what else you want to
do? Kule, you
can't
okay.
Basically, what's going to happen from here is I'm going to read this thing over the weekend, particularly the part that...
I'm agreeing with Chandi that what you also do in that process, you also try and clarify. You remember in that one meeting, there were also a few concerns that Regita had raised. You also try and clear those so that these actions are not necessarily seen as though they are collapsing in the left. I think that's very important.
Environmental effect, because most of the provisions like you outline are on their side. But we'll look at how to communicate, because we have got letters as well, because many people are going around and you know, scaring people.
I don't have any concerns. I, no, I'm I'm actually more conservative. I think you need to collect more. That's my general perspective of what should government be doing. So if the thing is, we had a situation when we were doing the pensions next. If you don't satisfy the first problem, where does this transaction? We haven't had this unnecessary also, there's a general perception that politicians couldn't do the problem. So I want us to unlock that. Even if it's including one flyer that you can introduce as empty, it needs to be clear because there's a misconception around the impact of the problem. It has been discussed in the public discourse. So all what I'm doing is to help unlock the potential of conversation. But we don't go back and forth to what we have done. We don't inform them because we know what other people do. They will go to the highest office and this letters will come back. We find ourselves discussing the issue that where there's no issue at all for discussion. So those are the things that I want to do. This means not share. The more we collect, the more we can contribute. That's how
I'm not a conservative, we're probably a progressive. But anyway, like, we're done, right? So basically, the report will be due Friday, and then we'll hear from you. Next point. Thank you very much. You will recall, colleagues, that we have a subcommittee set up. But on the Thursday morning, the mission came out for 2 hours. And then they met again for a whole day. I know,
Thank you.
present with their argument about the actual approach and how we're going to the amendment that's going to be done in the current text. There are those issues which we decided to make in the wisdom of the subcommittee to deal with all of those issues to the committee itself. We talked to them as we believe the amendments that we went through. And I think between ourselves, the members of the subcommittee and National Treasury, I think let's give you those amendments that we made. I think that's established with the amendments. The chair, the meeting with the chair, said, look, we're not voting today, but we just make sure that the amendments that we spoke about is agreed upon on those 2 days are elevated to the committee, the on an appropriate day. That the committee was to on the voting on those amendments. Roy, we do agree with the summary of the amendments that we did on this and then again we recommended those amendments to the committee. But can just for the sake of completeness, can we go through those amendments? Obvious when you come to the things that you said what are relating to the committee. I think in the first committee that those things we discussed so that we can make a position on that. Okay. Can you then make a speed up a bit?
Thank you very much. Yes, sir. We've got to the whole day, so we do go through everything so that we can do the process. And as the honourable speaker said, there was some issues which they've asked to elevate. Unfortunately, I noticed you've got a coloured track change version of the bill, but I've put it up on the screen. And then in the report that we circulated, we've summarised those issues. So if we go to page 2, there were some
of
the report. Which discusses, there was a lot of discussion around, you'll recall that the JAC made a substantial amount of inputs around exemptions. We've had a lot of conversations with them. Subsequently, they have clarified their position in an email to the Treasury, which I can circulate to the committee. And nevertheless, we feel that there should be a small change to the relevant section, and we laid that out in the table on page 2 of the report, which is to 28, which is to make the existing clause 49A1 as an exemption in terms of section 63M. And that just really talks to how 63M is set out in the law. I can show it to you if you like. It's a very small change, but I think it does go a long way clarifying this. It is not sorry, Chair, I missed the first one, which is that the committee felt that in responding to the G20 requirements and other multilateral institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank, there should be some latitude for the South Africa to consider its own goals. Treasury needs to be clear on its policy statements, how proposed and good for South Africa in terms of contributing to the growth of the world.
I think it's what has been coming through in all our discussions that why we want to be so fast, but let's not forget about our own needs, right? So we need to tailor-make this one to make sure that they also talk to the socio-economic imperatives of our country. And in regard, that's what it is.
Yeah, I know we certainly will do that in the future. Then item 37 was a slightly related issue, just to say the same thing, but it could be in terms of question Just to give the committee an idea of what Section 3 is all about and why it's so important, this is a section that explains exactly the conditions under which the exemption may be granted. So the legal advice we receive is that exemptions can be granted, but that the legislation has to be incredibly clear under which conditions the country may be allowed to grant exemptions. And so we have specified quite an extensive process of explaining under which conditions these exemptions can be provided. And perhaps I should actually go up to it while we're discussing the policy and see it. I just find it easier to work on the computer because it is not so I can find my way around using my find proposal. So there we've set out the exemption criteria. So you can only grant the exemption if it doesn't conflict with public interest. That is a very tough test. You basically have to prove that granting an exemption will not create a conflict with the public interest. And you have to prove that granting an exemption will not subject the achievement of the object of the act. In addition, when it comes to these particular types of exemptions, we put a new requirement in terms of ensuring the applicant, the size of their applicable financial other, will not have, if the granting of exemption will reduce an apparent hardship to them. And then three, this is a new section, in relation to the particular type of financial market infrastructure, the entire process that has to go through is to make sure that the applicant from the proven jurisdiction is authorized and licensed in that jurisdiction, complies with the criteria of the law, undertakes cooperation and share information with the authorities, to assist them with performing the functions and exercising the power to change their financial laws. So we feel by clarifying this, I think that we are quite comfortable that the concerns raised by the JSC have been sufficient. Are there any questions? I know there's probably two. Okay, then there was a concern in section 85 of the amendment, which was around the composition of the directors of market abuse. The committee felt that the list of people on the committee, on the directors, was quite narrow, and there was a proposal to actually increase the type of membership and the variety of membership, which Treasury has no problem with, and so we have proposed a clause that to add that we can have additional members. Proposing up to two additional persons in appropriate spirit and alternate to ensure that the directors comprise the appropriateness of the skills and skills. That hopefully will be enough to ensure that we can actually have experience. As I mentioned in the committee's meeting, the New York Fed, one of the members of the board of the New York Fed, is actually, I think almost by law, the head of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. The idea really just being that you want someone that is quite well known in the community, and it's quite a, because in New York, the head of one of the heads of the Metropolitan Museum of Art is actually a really significant person. So it gives you a kind of a mix of people that is a bit broader than just your usual accountant. there was that proposal, and so we were required to come back with a revision of our proposal. Okay, so I'll continue then. Then on the Long-Term Insurance Act, there was a lot of discussion around the role of funeral parlors. We are equally concerned. So what's happening in the area of insurance is that we're bringing, as you know, quite a substantial revision to the insurance bill, which is basically aimed at the momentum and discovery of insurers in the world. It's really to get them up to scratch with international best practice. Of course, they are not the only type of people that provide insurance in this country. Entities like funeral parlors and so forth provide what is essentially a type of insurance service, but is a type of service that is currently sort of regulated, but not completely regulated in an appropriate manner. And so when we get back to proposing the insurance bill, we will provide you with quite a lot of insight into the ideas that we have in terms of introducing what is called a micro-insurance framework, which is basically a framework, a very simple framework to ensure that we appropriately regulate funeral parlors. We all know that there are some funeral parlors that are quite good and don't run away with people's money, but there are other funeral parlors that certainly have been run away with people's money. And we think that that's quite an important component of the overall insurance framework. Then the second issue which came up, which is around the limitation on supporting certain shareholders and other interests in long-term insurers, there was a lot of discussion about the role of the authority to acquire or hold shares in long-term insurer. We will come back in the insurance bill with proposals around this. If there are no questions that are belonging to establishment of the appeal board. So in the Financial Sense Intelligence Act, there is an appeal board which basically provides you the opportunity to appeal decisions of the FIC to this appeal board. One of the issues is obviously that it is a very separate body from the rest of our financial system, and so people feel that we should have an appeal board that is the normal appeal board, and so you know exactly who you can go to if you are concerned about it. And so we have proposed to actually use the same financial services tribunal for the decision of the FIC, and there were some questions about the role of the procedures and so forth. We've had a lot of engagement with the FIC, and we have had discussions between legal teams, and I don't think we need to go into too much detail about it. We can if there are questions, but the feeling was that it would be perfectly workable to have the two appeal boards working. So you have the same institution to do appeals, although they would follow slightly different procedures for in the case of hearing FIC matters versus hearing matters from the other institution.
Was it the one that Advocate Jenkins raised? Remember during that term of...
Yeah.
So I'm not sure whether ultimately you were able to talk to Advocate Jenkins.
I don't think we have emailed him. I've seen a trail of emails. I think they have had discussions.
Okay, then.
We're going to get to the one that was the most specific. And I have asked Caroline. So there is a very interesting thing in the law. So how it works at the moment is if a company, let's take, I'm going to use my personal experience as an example. Let's say Discovery Life, and Caroline will correct me if I'm wrong. Let's say Discovery Life has a representative which comes and tries to sell me a financial service product. So their financial advisor, they phone you all the time and have to do tries to sell a product to you. They then discovers that the representative that is selling the product on their behalf is not fit and proper, and has maybe committed fraud, and has maybe not fulfilled the requirements of the law of the SAVE Act in terms of selling the product. my understanding is the obligation of discovery to disbar that person. So they can stop the person from selling their product and selling other products. Currently, the only way that that representative can appeal the decision is to appeal it to the High Court. We think that it's probably better if we have a much more straightforward financial file to appeal the decision. So we are making the proposal that the financial representative can appeal the decision to the financial service tribunal, which is easier than it is at the moment. However, the committee did raise concerns about the confidence venue of allowing the firm to buy this. I think Caroline is much closer. I'm going to ask her to make an additional comment.
Thank you, sir. We did ask the discussions committee to submit a memo on the history of the debarment, and I'm sure the entire committee received it. But essentially, if we consider that we are regulating 125,000 trusts, and we had as much as 137,000 represented in our database, the SAFE Act was structured in such a way in 2002 to give the responsibility to the financial service providers to ensure that people they recruit are fit and proper, and to ensure that they remain fit and proper, and should they become unfit and improper, have the right to debar them to protect customers from dishonest persons. And there was some concern in the committee about the ability or the fact that the Act gave administrative powers to financial service providers. There was a question by the committee as to whether this had ever been constitutionally challenged, and the answer is yes. It's now going through a constitutional challenge, which is being addressed through a process. But essentially, in terms of the document we submitted to the committee, we gave the legal arguments or the legal grounds for allowing self-regulate the type of structure in the industry, simply because of the volumes involved and the fact that the financial service providers are closer to the representatives than we at the FSB are. We did feel, however, that there was one area of abuse where financial service providers were not following proper administrative process in terms of pressure, and therefore proposed a consequential amendment to set up the due process that must be followed to ensure that representatives are treated fairly, and also as lawyers said, to introduce the right for them to appeal to the financial services board tribunal, the FSBA tribunal, rather than have to take a high court decision as well. Representatives must be fairly.
Any comment? So Roy was then saying that the what are we then saying about the first service provider or financial service provider can't just really need it to it. There's a process that one should go through, right? To ensure that there's an administrative justice in the whole process. That's one. And two, the question of the cost for individuals. We spoke about the David in the court there. When people must always go to high court to challenge things. The assumption that is always there that this is being done free of charge can be a very expensive process, that's one. And two, let's also not be naive that the employer can abuse that. I think that's where we're coming from. That can be abused by the employer. So let's just make sure that there's some balance when you deal with the financing. So we are saying you have dealt with this, right, in the manner that you have. I would like to hear comments from Honourable Member of the Kenny, or if there are other areas of clarification on this matter, because it's one area that we spend a lot of time on.
As I understand it, this is a system that's been operating for some time. Once the request for surgery to provide
agenda, I think, was submitted to the committee.
Have we had this? Maybe I've forgotten.
Which is where the financial service provider merged bar has been in place since 2002. And over that period, we have recorded 6,000, and I'm talking from the top of my head from the member submission, 6,700 debarments over that period. The FSB also has the power to debar, which is under Section 48, and that was introduced in 2008. And we have debarred just over 1,000 persons under 14A. The largest proportion of the debarments, if I can share with the committee, are where the largest proportion that we see is where fraudulent policies, where fraudulent policies are submitted by advisors, unbeknownst to the customer, so they earn the commission. The customer doesn't see the debit order until it's too late, and very often the advisor puts their own beneficiaries under the policy so that they can claim from the insured's life. That's the largest abuse we see. Currently dealing with cases of 120 cases of fraudulent qualifications, where people defraud their qualifications. So those are the kinds of honesty cases we see, but the numbers are around, I've got them right here. So 6,772 debarments in 2016 and 1,190 by the Financial Services Board.
But also you, through you check, they have said that the issue of constitutionality of the also referred to nothing.
What happened is is there any application process for failure of those people, or we have terminated the investigation for that?
Chair, under 14.1, you're debarred for a period of 12 months by law, and then after that 12-month period, you have to go through a process of reappointment. The process of reappointment is also set down in the law that the appointing financial service provider has to ensure that the person is rehabilitated and that it's been possible for appointment, and then re-registered them with the financial service board. If the FSB debars, the period can be longer than 12 months.
I think we can proceed with speculate the set of documents, but I think it's clear what we're trying to achieve, to try and get some balance of control.
Chair, I have to say that if it's useful, we could maybe carry on to the then we can start.
Let's do that.
So essentially, I mean, I know there's blocking off my heart, so I'm just trying to open my laptop to the document. But essentially, what we did, is we set out the clarification on the purpose of the debarment process under the SAVE Act. Can you hear me? I think I set it out in a high-level summary, but we have seen a number of challenges at the FSB regarding debarment. And so this document is mostly set out from affidavits submitted to the Supreme Court of Appeal where the debarment process was upheld. And the debarment process was upheld not only in terms of the financial service provider like the family is worth it to borrow you, but that you are precluded from working in the entire industry as a consequence of that involvement as an effort to protect consumers from fraudulent persons. And basically the document sets up a structure as to why it was structured in that way to allow the SSB to have sufficient resources to ensure that fraudulent or dishonest persons are precluded from acting in the industry by virtue of, as I said, the number of representatives in the industry, as well as the fact that the financial service provider has a responsibility directly to ensure that it gives them sufficient profit, and therefore if they become sufficient profit or closer to that representative to manage that case. We did find that in some cases the financial service providers make lose What is not in the document, that I must add, Chair, is that we have advised that we have debarred under 14A 1,190 representatives. We have actually received 3,000 applications for debarment and only debarred 1,190. The main reason being is that very often a representative may resign and disappear to avoid legal action or to avoid debarment. And then we can't get them on, we can't follow up budget and give them due process. So what we do is we write a list of methods to get the income back. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms.
Chair.
Thank you, Ms.
Okay, thank you.
So it's for life?
No.
Debarment is for life.
So, the 14-1 debarment is 12 months. And after 12 months, you have to go through a process of reappointment. And if the SSB debars you for a particular period, and it can be anywhere from 1 year to 5 years to 10 years.
Thank you. Gemin, and in the case where a debarment period is, what are the obligations on the financial service provider
I want to comment on two aspects of that question. A person can be debarred if they're family. That can be a financial issue, it can also be a competency issue. If a person's incompetent because it hasn't got the necessary qualifications or examinations, they can also be debarred. They can easily be reappointed as soon as they get the qualifications or examinations. So it's not just for dishonesty. The 14A cases we deal with are usually dishonesty. And the industry can deal with both. With regards to reporting to SAP, we report all cases of where we find criminal behavior in our own cases under 14A, we report them to SAP. I don't know that there's a written obligation on the industry to report to SAP in terms of the case law, that there obviously may be a common law requirement to report to SAP if they have a crime.
Thank you. I think let's proceed. I think we've covered the issue. From where I am, I think we were sort of trying to get the balance that we wanted to get from the way it goes, right? Meaning to ensure that there is no malfeasance emanating from the people who are being debarred and so on, but at the same time, we're saying we don't want to see the abuse of the employers, so to speak.
Thank you, Chair. At that particular session, we didn't have an industry agreement with the industry representative. Okay, so I wanted to be comfortable for them to respond on the
I thought I'll allow the industry to comment on the end, but this one is a burning issue. Why don't I allow the industry, anyone from the industry, to comment on specifically on this one?
central comments made initially, but with various discussions and explanations from the Financial Services Board and National Treasury, I think those have been ironed out, and the CISA members are satisfied. There was some difficulty that the CISA members too had with the debarring that they would be required to do when they discovered improper behavior or people who didn't have qualifications, etc. And the difficulty, primary difficulty, is exactly as the FSB experienced it, where people would disappear in order to avoid the process being completed, which was of concern because you would not be in a position to debar somebody who should not be operating in the industry because of the type of lack of honesty and integrity that they had displayed. But then because they had disappeared, it was not possible to go through a process. The industry is also very conscious of having to follow labor law requirements, and it's been quite a complex process and a careful process that has had to be followed in order to ensure fairness. And but the amendments that we did request in order to make the process operate more smoothly while remaining fair do appear in the latest draft, in the October draft that was published on Friday. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Something just comes to my mind, especially around competence, which in some instances may be very subjective, right? And you may find that what the employer would like to do is just to follow labor law and dismiss that person without debarring him or her, right? I don't know if you make any differentiation of that, because the fact that I may have been incompetent as far as the standards, which are very high in company A, may not give you a right to start debarring the employee for another company.
What I'd like to start with is that a person may only be debarred in terms of non-compliance with the FAES Act. The FAES Act is very specific as to competency. It's not subjective at all. And it's proportionate in terms of if you're selling a very simple product, your competency levels are a lot lower than if you're selling security and instruments, they're a lot higher. But we set the minimum standards, and you may only debar in terms of FAES. You may not debar in terms of your own subjective interpretation.
Thank you, Ron. Let's proceed.
The chair in then on the Corporate Bank Act, we had a very interesting discussion, and I think we agreed to that the Corporate Bank Act because one of the people of this session in the whole country discussion and all the hearings is actually never really had an opportunity to explain and to explain what we're trying to do in terms of amending it. So we have got an amendment to the Corporate Bank Act. I think the view of the committee was that there wasn't anything contentious in the amendment. But the committee conceptually did feel that it would be useful for the Corporate Bank Development Agency to come and present what they do. And we have no objection to that. Unfortunately, we have to do the time today, but if you like, Chair, we could have an opportunity sometime in the last remaining hearings to let them come and present to you. Really, what the intention of this agency is on the 37th floor in the Treasury, and the Treasury supports it, so we have a standing budget allocation for the Corporate Bank Development Agency of about 16 million a year, and the agency has a number of staff that go around the country and assist corporate banks to develop. So a corporate bank is really a collection of individuals. They have to meet, prove a common bond. So generally they have a geographic bond, so they're often in the same area, and they put together what is called the corporate bank, and that provides for an opportunity for people to pool resources, pool money, and lend to one another. We have tried this out a number of years ago. It's not working as well as we'd like it to work. We've got a lot of ideas in terms of how we can improve it. And the amendments that we put into place are part of the process of trying to improve this cost of that idea and to improve the process of the cost. have done in the amendment is to clarify more specifically that the supervision of cooperative banks will move to the Prudential Authority. This has been one of the areas which I think has confused the cooperative banks a bit as an agency in their mandate, because on one hand they have to actually help cooperative banks develop, and on the other hand they have to supervise them and make sure that they are complying with the law. And it's a bit of a grey area when you are both supervising an entity and trying to help it develop. It creates strange conflicts of interest for the agency itself, and that we don't think that's great. So we are clarifying that the supervision of cooperative banks will move to the Prudential Authority, and we might have got a whole team set up to do that, and that will also free up resources for the agency to go out and do its work. We had a big tour, they went to Limpopo and to the Northwest about 2 weeks ago, and they mentioned a bunch of the whole board of the agency actually, and from all accounts it was a really useful tour. So we thought they could come and present to you on what they're trying to do and what the work program is and the challenges they face. I think it was very useful from the discussion that's been going on in terms of transforming the sector, because really this is, I think from our perspective, really important to get a
No, Chair, I think Roy has covered mostly what we spoke about, and I think just for the benefit of the committee, the way the Cooperative Development Agency is working sort of mitigates all the financial inclusion concept. That's why you also thought maybe let's have them come in to present to the committee so that we can broadly understand their role and how we can also make sure that people are aware of this agency and how they can But right, there was also this, there was somewhere where there was the Minister of DTI and Minister of Finance responsible. I'm not sure whether it was on this one or on the other.
No,
one where we were also saying the reporting lines and other things that could be discussed,
No, absolutely, I don't know, that's pretty correct, and actually I want to put it up. There was, the agent, there are two, once again there's a bit of a shared competency here. The responsibility for cooperatives lies with, it used to lie with the Department of Trade and Industry, it now lies with the Department of Small Business. The responsibility for cooperative banks, so as soon as you start providing banking service or financial services, then it lies with the Treasury, because it's a financial service. So we have actually made amendments to the Cooperative Banks Act to clarify better where you lie and how you lie. And one of the things that we're going to be doing as part of a big review is whether or not the function of actually cooperative bank development should move across to the Department of Small Business. They have an agency called the Small Enterprise Development Agency, which reports to the Minister of Small Business. It might be better for that agency to actually be the Cooperative Bank Development Agency rather than the Treasury.
Yeah.
We don't have any problem with that.
No, I think this thing
is
beginning to
help
define because it's not what it is.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
That was all. I think the other areas is actually we're having mutual banks, policy board, financial services, short-term insurance, international financial institutions act, financial institutions, National Credit Act. There were discussions on that, and we went over all the issues. There were no concerns. I think that we have really found each other between the Treasury and the Cooperative Bank, between the Department of Trade and Industry. There's been an enormous amount of engagement, and we are quite happy now that both departments are sort of happy with, I think, where we are and how we're going to deal with the overlap.
you.
I just let you know the chairperson of Schengen Ministry did contact me. She promised to send me a document about the amendment. I don't know about it in the I was concerned, but now the Board Department suggested. So I don't really think on this issue. There is another issue coming in here that we should raise. We keep getting told that the national credit regulation and everything our right to them are being
NCR.
We just write to them and say, look, we see other people are speaking. Now, there may be individuals there that are elected members of the committee. So it's a bunch of individuals. But as far as I know, we've been sitting here. They made a submission in the first year, which is very weak. I wrote, I found it. The second time they sent us the email, I spoke to all of this in 2004. Just to avoid problems.
Thank you, Roy. So just to confirm certain things, the amendments that we are talking about, just for the benefit of the committee members, we went clause by clause on all the day, on the 2 days that we have in schedule four, making sure that we check all the amendments, we do the amendments and so on, and we make propositions of amendments. So we did that. Now, the question to National Treasurer is that in this schedule, all these amendments that we are referring to, they have been incorporated into this document.
Yes, Chair, they have been incorporated. In particular, the most significant change since the document that we tabled at that meeting that is actually the National Credit Act amendments, which we have got to put them on the screen. These are the new ones. They actually are quite minor, but they are the outcome of the discussions between the two departments, and they relate specifically to the credit ombuds, which needs to be incorporated in our ombud scheme. Originally, the credit ombud, in any case, fell under the Financial Services Ombud Schemes Act, so we just need to clarify that it lies within our act. And that's really all that has changed from the version we saw. The document we circulated where we've made amendments, those all indicate on track changes, and those are the ones that I have walked you through now.
Thank you. Honorable Kikana. Members of the committee, are we covered? It's a pity Brendan is not here, but it is saying that we all participated and the members of the subcommittee made very much invaluable contributions. I that be what you are saying, that everything has been incorporated into this document.
Yeah.
So, honourable members, I won't be going back to this document and we go again clause by clause.
Yeah.
I think we'll take it that all the clauses, the amendments that have been made, yeah, feel free to go back and look into this document. If there are issues that still
Chair, I think before I then close my session, I think it's proper for me to thank National Treasury and the team, right, for the cooperation with the small committee of the big committee, the subcommittee. Thank you, FSD.
So you are a small chair.
Yeah. Okay. thank, and also our gratitude to the industry for the input.
Don't forget Cape Town. Are you there?
Yes, we connected with Cape Town through the teleconference, Chair. The whole team was there, and we checked on them whether they were not sleeping the side. So we found out that they were always on their toes. So members of the subcommittee, thank you very much. Members of the committee, thank you. That brings my session to the end.
Thank you
very much,
Sipiso.
Thank you, Sipiso. We're very grateful for your work. Now, as far as the process goes, now obviously we're not going back to the 20th until after the NTC. So that gives Frank to go through and just check. Because most of us are not this now. So the point is, when we come back to this, and I don't know where you're going to be, you've given the date, right? I hope we can stick by that. Then we will look at the actual vote. We're not coming back to the schedule. We're just going to vote on this stuff. Unless Frank or somebody picks up. So we'll just vote on the schedule. For the sake of the vote, we're going to look very closely to it. Because they're just outstanding issues. When would you have that thing?
We have completed a fully track change version of the bill. We placed it on our website, www.treasury.gov.nz/complete, and we have circulated that to the committee. I think we circulated that with this pack, but we can recirculate it. I'm going to check with the committee.
Just a very quick thing. Are you asking for comments from the public on your latest version, or are you just putting it for
information? No, Chair, it's only for information. It's on your, I think you asked us to place it on our website.
So what are we asking of industry and whoever else? Can you respond to that within, say, by next Wednesday to the committee, right, to Element Table, with any comments you've got on that one? And that's your last. We're not having any public hearing.
No.
Briefing. I would like, if possible, colleagues, that we finish this story this year. And even vote on it in the House. If we can't, we do it and we'll come back. So we're giving you this last chance just to look at it. Which is not saying it was worth it, but if you don't agree with it, just come and tell us. We're not going to do it. And we will decide. Okay, thank you all. We shall see you for the lockdown. It's the 10 o'clock tomorrow. And I hope you're all behaved. Thank you very much.